share with you from the scriptures, beginning at Exodus 14, some thoughts on crisis management. Crisis management. And I will say that the principles that we will see tonight can be applied across a broad range of life circumstances at any time. God doesn't change in his dealings with people, past, present, or future. And there are certain reasons why we find ourselves oftentimes in the predicaments that we land in. But we may have this confidence that as long as we are in the will of God, that God has guaranteed certain things to us. And there's an underlying theme that we're going to look at tonight when it concerns, that deals with the matter of prayer in relationship to crisis management. And I want you to see in Exodus chapter 14, and beginning at the sixth verse, we'll just lay a little bit of a foundation here. We know that this is the great chapter of Israel's deliverance from Egypt after three or four centuries of occupation there. And we see in verse number 6 that he, meaning Pharaoh, made ready his chariot and took his people with him. He took 600 chosen chariots and all the chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he pursued after the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with a high hand. But the Egyptians pursued them. All the horses and chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamping by the sea. I would say, just looking at that at verse 9, that qualifies for a genuine crisis in light of the geographical nature of the dilemma. Israel has nowhere to go. From a human perspective, there is no solution. They have the sea in front of them. They have Pharaoh and his army behind them. And Pharaoh would have them back in bondage. Now, they have some options at this point. They can wave a white flag and say to Pharaoh, we'll go back and spare the lives. They could do that. They can't run anywhere, but they are in a crisis of sorts where there does not seem to be any human solution for the dilemma at hand. My question to you is this. Are they at this point in the going in the will of God? Are they found where they're supposed to be at this point in their history? Yes, they are. They are in the will of God, which lesson number one, we learn that you can be in the will of God, doing the will of God, and still find yourself facing circumstances that defy a solution. And that in itself may cause you to question whether or not you're doing what's right. But Israel had seen its time in slavery in Egypt, and now they were to proceed out. They were in the will of God. Nevertheless, Pharaoh overtakes them. Now, in verse number 10, when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. May I say to you that you may be in the will of God, doing the will of God, and still find yourself very afraid. Very afraid. Fear comes when you can't see a way out. You're convinced in your mind, your conscience tells you that you're doing what's right. You're right where you ought to be. But the circumstance in front of you defies explanation, and it brings out fear. And so they're afraid. Then it says the children of Israel did something. Very critical Hebrew word here in this text. They cried. They cried. It's a Hebrew word that means literally to shriek. To shriek. Now, shriek is something that, you know, you can go left or right with a definition of it or an illustration of it. But basically, it arises out of a deep emotional state of distress where one senses danger or they're in a pit of anguish. And the immediate response to what they see and sense is that they shriek. It's an audible expression. But in this case, the children of Israel cried out to God. They sensed danger. They sensed danger. Now, may I say to you that this, when it says cry here, may I say that's a form of prayer that will not be practiced by God's people until and unless they come to the same place in their life where they sense anguish or danger without solution. And I would ask that as you travel on here, as God's people, as members of Grace Baptist Church, that you would pray that God would give you discernment to be able to look around you and see what's looming. With the desire that it might energize you individually and our church corporately when it comes to this matter of prayer that I believe is absolutely critical for the long-term survivability of this church or any church. When a church comes near to closing the doors on prayer meeting night, which is becoming commonplace, the church basically, if you can use a medical analogy, is almost flatlined. They're basically going to maybe keep operations going on the Lord's Day, but it's just going to be according to a form, ceremony, or ritual. Because as I've mentioned to you before, prayer is the lungs of the church, the very breath on which it survives. And when that fails, the church flatlines. So I want you to ask God for your discernment to look at what's going on around you nationally, ecclesiastically, within the fellowship of your churches, and with the fellowship among the members of your own church. Among the members of your own church. Just take a real close, discerning look. Now, there's an Old Testament commentary that describes what happened when the people of Israel cried out over in the book of Joshua. Chapter 24. There's a good little reference here. In Joshua 24, verse 6, he's recounting for the people of his generation the mighty works of God in the previous generations. And I will say, here's another lesson. Wise is the Christian who knows Christian history. Wise is the Christian who knows theological history. And here Joshua is presenting truths. He's being a faithful teacher where he's passing on truths that he has learned to the next generation. After the principle that we find in Deuteronomy. Parents passing on to their children the truth of that generation. It's a device where not so much structured, formal classroom instruction as it is families in those days using conversation in the family about the faith and about the works of God, so that the children were constantly exposed by way of their parents to the impressions and convictions of their parents, and that generation then received the full benefit of their experience. And so here we find in verse 6, I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came unto the sea, and the Egyptians pursued after your fathers with chariots and horsemen unto the Red Sea. Now look at verse 7, commentary. And when they cried, same word, when they shrieked unto the Lord, He put darkness between you and the Egyptians, and brought the sea upon them, and covered them. And your eyes have seen what I have done in Egypt. Now, just a comment here for a minute. And this is a lesson to consider when you doubt the point of prayer itself. Here's the kind of God that you pray to. When Israel was delivered, from what you know of your Bible history, what did He do to deliver Israel? What did He do? Right there at the Red Sea. Okay, parted the waters. Wide enough for a couple of million people with all their animals and wagons and stuff to get across. And I want to remind you something. And He did it on hard pack, so that not one of them tracked in mud to the other side. Now think about that for a minute. When something like a seabed is saturated for who knows how long with water, and all of a sudden the water disappears, even in that kind of a scenario, it takes a period of time for the seabed to dry. But I remind you that the Lord instantly dried a soggy, muddy, soppy seabed and made it hard packed so that the people of Israel could get across without tracking mud to the other side. And then when Israel got, or when Egypt come down through there with their chariots, He instantly turned that hard pack to mud, caused the axles and the wheels to break on the chariots, and then after they were trapped, caused the waters to come back over. Now that's the kind of God, when you cry out to, hears your prayers. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that we have prayer meetings in which people go to wholesale shrieking, you know, like a bonsai charismatic group. What I am saying to you that the shriek that we're talking about here is a spontaneous emotional reaction to what the individual perceives in front of them. It's not a prayer technique that we use to get God's favor, like He's deaf or something, or indifferent. Now, there is another occurrence here. Look over in the Chronicles. 2 Chronicles 13. And if you would please, verses 14 and 15. Here's a story with Abijah and Jeroboam. They're going to square off and have a battle. If you look at the context, the question I would ask you is Abijah and Judah in the right place at the right time? Are they doing the will of God? Abijah appeals to Jeroboam. Let's not fight. Don't put the battle in array. We don't need to do this. Jeroboam, over there in verse number 12, decided to disregard the appeal of Abijah. In verse 13, it says, he caused an ambushment to come about behind them so that they were before Judah, and the ambushment was behind them. And when Judah looked back, behold, the battle was before and behind. So please understand the situation now. Would that qualify as a genuine crisis there? As Abijah and Judah, they looked behind them, and Jeroboam snuck back there and set an ambush. And in front of them, they're sort of like Israel at the Red Sea. There's nowhere to go. They're sandwiched in. What did they do? Two things here. Verse 15, the men of Judah, or pardon me, you get to the end of verse 14. They cried unto the Lord. And the priests sounded with the trumpets. Okay, just let me say this to you. And when we look at these verses, we no doubt in my mind that they are in the will of God. They're right where they need to be. And yet they find themselves between a rock and a hard place. And just because you're in the will of God does not mean that you will not find yourself facing an inescapable or irreconcilable dilemma. And that's always and there's a purpose behind all of that. God sometimes puts us in the middle of something without any exits available to bring us to a course of action that leads us right to Him. And so here's what they did. They cried unto the Lord. Now that's the same word to shriek, literally to shout. And may I say in verse 15 that the men of Judah did what? They gave a shout. Literally, that's a Hebrew word that means to split the ear. The decibel level was so high. Now, there's a lesson in this as well. We believe that God is the sovereign creator and can do anything, do we not? Nothing is too hard for Him. Now, there will be many people who sit back on the sovereignty of God and say, I'm a man of faith or a woman of faith, and I'm going to pray and I'm just going to leave it there. So I would say that's the kind of person you don't want to have next to you in the foxhole or in the trench. You've got the enemy here. You've got the enemy there. We don't dare lift our heads above the hole. We're going to get shot. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to bow my head and I'm going to ask God to deliver us. And that's it. I'm going to hunker down, pull my hat over my head, put my flak jacket up over, and I'm just going to stay here until God takes care of it. And there are some people who think like that. But the lesson we have in this is, first of all, the priests sounded the trumpets. Now they're going to take some decisive military action. And then it says the men gave a shout. Now, in ancient warfare, it was quite common that when a military attack would be launched, the warriors would in unison shout so as to intimidate their enemy and then rush at them full bore, hoping that the enemy might be so feared that they would turn about and run away. So what we see here is, on the one hand, prayer that links us to the sovereignty of God, but does not excuse man from exercising due prudence and responsibility. If I'm going to cry out to God for deliverance, then I'm going to also stand up and make a run at the enemy. Even though there's the enemy here and the enemy there, and I don't know how that's going to turn out. Sometimes when God puts us into the middle of something and we're in the will of God, He puts us there to see whether or not we are trusting in our own human ingenuity or we are simply, barely, and transparently trusting in His wisdom. And so what happened? It came to pass that God smote Jeroboam and all Israel before Abijah and Judah. Doesn't say how exactly, but God did it. And what was the solution there? Well, they were between a rock and a hard place. And they cried. They cried. And I say again, that until a person or people get to a place where they sense danger, when they do not see an exit left or right, only then will they be led to cry out with the same degree of urgency and desperation. And that is why I ask for you to pray that God would give you the discernment to look around you and see what's going on. See what's going on in your families. See what's going on in your church. See what's going on in the fellowship of churches. Have a look at what's going on nationally. And the good thing that comes out of this is that God's people once again return to their basic root in the full and real exercise of the faith, which starts right at prayer. Right at prayer. Over in chapter 14, there's a story about Asa. Look at the 11th verse. There's a band of Ethiopians, 1.3 million, I believe, led by Zerah, that is squaring off against Asa in verse 9. And please notice in verse 10. Here's, now catch this. Now, if you're him, and you got 1.3 million chariots with warriors facing you. Is that not an intimidating sight? But what does Asa do in verse 10? It says he went out against him. And they set the battle in array in the valley. Okay? Then, in verse 11, Asa does what? Now, the way Asa says, Asa cried. Now, it's a different Hebrew word that doesn't have the sense of shriek, but rather means it has the idea of shouting out to get somebody's attention. And if you look at the word in its context, you see that Asa, in the nature of the prayer that he makes, exudes a confidence in God that is rare even among evangelicals today. What does he ask? He cried unto the Lord his God and said, Lord, it is nothing with thee to help, whether with many or with them that have no power. They've got 1.3 mil. We don't have that. And he just issues this request, two little words, help us. Help us. O Lord our God, for we rest on thee, and in thy name we go against this multitude. O Lord, thou art our God. Let not man prevail against us. And so what happens in verse 12? Lord smote the Ethiopians. They ran. They ran. They made quite a dust cloud in retreat. Now, does that verse 11 remind you of an illustration of a single Israelite teenager that basically had approached a superior force with the same degree of confidence in his God? Who has that been? Yeah, old David. Now, he was not arrogant to confide in the arm of the flesh or his own ability, but his confidence was in his God. Asa cried unto the Lord, and the Lord intervened. Now, I want one more in the 18th chapter before we quit. Chapter 18 is good King Jehoshaphat. Now, I want to remind you that where it was with Abijah, with Asa, they were right where they were supposed to be, doing what they were supposed to do. In chapter 18, verse number 1 gives you a tip-off. Jehoshaphat, good King Jehoshaphat, joins affinity with Ahab. Ahab, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being rank and 10 being sweet, where does Ahab rank? 1. Or minus. Okay. Ahab is a jerk. Okay. Anyhow, he joins affinity with them, and they decide they're going to go to battle. And Jehoshaphat is willing, but he says to Ahab, look, let's inquire with God to see whether it's good or not. And okay, so he gets the 400 prophets who come and who spill the party line and say, yeah, Ahab, you go up against the enemy. No problem. Everything will go fine. Jehoshaphat, for some reason, is there not another prophet around that we could inquire a little bit more? And Ahab says, yes, there's one other one, but I hate him. I hate him. Well, why? Well, because he always tells me what I don't want to hear. That doesn't change from generation to generation. The prophets and the preachers and the teachers and the parents who are hated by the secular crowd are those who always tell them what they don't want to hear. The way to get along, to go along with anybody and everybody, is tell them what they want to hear. So the prophet comes and he is reminded by the henchmen of the king, look, when you get in front of the king, you tell him exactly what he wants to hear. So he did. Micaiah comes in there and he tells Ahab exactly what he wants to hear. But for some strange reason, old Ahab rebukes him. He must have sensed in the sarcasm of his expression that he wasn't really being truthful and forthright. Then the prophet tells him, says, you're not going to come back out of this battle. So Ahab doesn't like to hear that. He puts the guy in jail, gives him bread and water, to which the prophet says, look, if you come back, then the Lord hasn't spoken by me. But you're not going to come back. Now, Jehoshaphat's witnessed all this. I look at verse number 31. Is Jehoshaphat where he's supposed to be? Is he in the will of God? Is he a good man? He's a good man. Which lesson is, sometimes good men get out of the will of God. Sometimes good men make bad relationships with the wrong kind of people. Should he have been a pal to Ahab? No. Should he have gone to battle with Ahab? No. So here he finds himself in verse 31. It came to pass when the captain of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat that they said, it is the king of Israel. Here's another lesson. If you hang close with the world, it's not long before you act like them, you cater to them, and you look like them. And here, Jehoshaphat is mistaken for Ahab. And they trap him. And then what do we see old Jehoshaphat doing at the bottom of verse 31? Jehoshaphat what? Now I ask you, did he simply shout out to get God's attention, or do you think he shrieked? He shrieked. He sensed the danger, and there was a spontaneous eruption out of his heart, wanting God to help. I have no idea what he said. I can only speculate that he might now have realized that he was in the wrong place. Lord, I'm sorry. I'll never let this happen again. Who knows what he said? But bottom line is, what did God do? Was he obligated to help him? Nope. But God moved them to depart from him. Lesson we learn is sometimes good men get out of the will of God, and though God is not obligated to help, he sometimes does. And Jehoshaphat is spared. But you know, he's not obligated. Think about this. Think about old Samson. Was Samson in the will of God where Delilah was concerned? No. Did he tell Delilah something he shouldn't have told her? Yes. And so we find him at the end of his day in a pagan temple, chained to the pillars, and he makes one last prayer. But is God going to spare his life in this process? No. He's going to bring the temple down and take a bunch of pagans with him, but Samson is going to lose his life in the process. Point is, like Jehoshaphat, he heard the word of God out of the mouth of the prophet and chose to ignore it. And he put himself in a bad, bad spot that nearly cost him his life, except for the mighty providence and the magnificent mercy of God. When you think about crisis management, my first stop, second stop, and last stop is prayer. Prayer. And I'm not suggesting to you again that the word cry is the introduction of a new prayer technique so much as it is an eruption out of the heart of an individual who senses desperation. And God sometimes brings us there to bring us to Him. Because sometimes it's too easy to rely on the human avenue for relief. And sometimes what the psalmist says to us, that the answer is not in the horses that pull the chariots, nor in the legs of man that run, but in God Himself. It's not by my might, nor by my power, but by the Spirit, saith the Lord.